So, called A Cosmological Insight into Fundamental Physics. And basically what I wanted to give you was a very brief overview, to start off, of the tools that we can use to measure fundamental physics using cosmology, and what's being done with those at the moment. So the tools that we use, I would generally class in these are my symbols that I use for four different sort of types of tools that we use. First, candles, standard candles, something of known or understandable luminosity. Standard rulers, something of known length. Standard clocks, something of known duration. And motion, which doesn't necessarily be standard, something, some understandable motion in the universe. And these, I think, are the broad classes of types of observations that we can make in the universe. And so I'm going to talk about how we use these to learn about fundamental physics. Now, I've enlisted the help of a couple of the other postdocs in astrophysics at University of Queensland. So Sine and David are going to be jumping up and giving 5 minutes during my talk as well of some more specific things of their specialties that's related to this topic. So cosmology has sort of come of age, I would say, in the sense that it really is able to put constraints on fundamental physics these days. We know that heaps of money is being spent at the moment on ever more sophisticated experiments to test the basis of our knowledge. And so things like the Large Hadron Collider and Super Kamiokande Condi, the neutrino detector, are all doing different sort of high energy and all sort of particle physics experiments to figure out what the universe is made of. And test our standard model of particle physics. But it's handy that the universe routinely does experiments on time, length, energy scales that we just can't possibly hope to achieve here on Earth. So the energy of cosmic rays in the atmosphere is higher than any collisions that we're going to be able to do with a Large Hadron Collider, which is my favourite way of explaining that we're not going to create Earth-destroying black holes with the Large Hadron Collider. And so what I'm mostly interested in terms of cosmology, is using the experiments that the universe is doing every day to do experiments like what we're trying to do on Earth to figure out fundamental physics. And that includes things like what's dark matter and dark energy. So can we test the standard model of particle physics? Are there new theories of physics like string theories, brain theories? What can we learn about those by measuring cosmology? And other things associated with testing our standard model of particle physics is can the constants of nature vary, for example. So one excellent example of the way cosmology can constrain fundamental physics is talking about the neutrino mass. Now, usually at this point in this talk, I would go into some detail about cosmology, how cosmology can be used to constrain the neutrino mass. But I'm going to leave that to Sine to talk about in a few minutes. So another thing that we like testing are different theories of fundamental physics. So there's a bunch of different models that we use to try and explain the acceleration of the universe. Here's a couple, but as with the neutrinos, I'm actually going to skip over that because that's what David's going to talk about in a little while. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a slightly biased view of what's going on, because I'm going to talk about mostly the things that I've been more involved in cosmology. And the first measurement that we use that I was involved in is supernovae, which we use as standard candles. Now, these are good to learn about the universe. There's this particular type of supernova that always explodes to the same brightness, which is handy because just by measuring how bright they appear, you can compare that to its intrinsic brightness and infer how far it is away. Measuring distances in astrophysics is really hard, so having a standard candle like that is extremely useful. Once you know the distance, You can combine that with the measurement of its recession velocity thanks to its redshift that we measure with the spectrum. So, and you get a measure of its redshift, which tells you how fast the supernova and the galaxy that hosts it is moving away. Once you've got the velocity, what this gives you is that if you know things are at large distances, you know that because the distances are so enormous in cosmology, you're looking at the universe as it was a long time ago. So we can detect these supernovae back to more than half the age of the universe ago, 6-7 billion years ago. So when you're looking at that, you can look at there and look at how fast these supernovae were moving away at that time and compare them to nearby supernovae and how fast they're moving away now, and figure out whether the expansion of the universe has sped up or slowed down in that time. When you do that experiment, lo and behold, shock horror, the universe is actually accelerating. And that's something that doesn't come under the purview of any of our standard physics. It means either we've got, we need to revise our theory of gravity. It doesn't work at long scales the way we thought it did, because gravity should only ever pull. It should decelerate the universe, not accelerate it. So something's going on there. So either our theory of gravity doesn't work quite right, or we have some sort of material or something that has an anti-gravity property. So that anti-gravity is the leading contender for that is vacuum energy at the moment, which is actually predicted by quantum physics, even though quantum physics predicts, well, potentially 120 orders of magnitude too much of it. So there's problems there, but that's one of the reasons why it's so interesting. Trying to figure out why the universe is accelerating has become a major theme of cosmology and is a massive observational push has gone to try and classify what exactly it is. What I've plotted here is actually the supernova observational data. Here you've got distance, which is basically its brightness up on the vertical axis compared to its redshift on the horizontal axis. And the three lines that are here, so the grey points in the background are actually the data, and the black points are the binned up data. We know there's some intrinsic dispersion there. The three models are three different models of the universe. The first one, they're all based on general relativity, but the first one, the blue dotted line or dashed line, is an empty universe that's not accelerating or decelerating at all. The green line is what you would expect if you're in a universe with only matter. That includes dark matter, and if it was at 30% the critical density. So that is the curve you would expect to see if you only had matter. If you add a cosmological constant, which is one type of dark energy, I didn't actually say so, dark energy being the name we give to whatever is causing the expansion of the universe, whether it be a different theory of gravity or different particles or whatever. So the red line is what you expect when you add dark energy into the mix, and that's the best fitting models that we have at the moment. And so you can see that this is a much better fit than the model without it. The way we usually quantify this is we put those models appear in some sort of parameter space. Here we've got matter density on the horizontal axis and the equation of state of dark energy on the vertical axis. Now, if the dark energy is a cosmological constant or plain old vacuum energy, then you would expect it to have an equation of state of minus one. And on this plot, I've plotted the likelihood contours. So this is a one sigma likelihood contour from the supernovae, showing which region of that plane is allowed by the supernova data. When you combine that with other data, which I'll talk about in a minute, from the cosmic microwave background and baryon acoustic oscillations, you zoom in on this region here, which is our standard model of the universe at the moment, with an equation of state of one minus one dark energy, matter density just under 0.3. So that's our model at the moment. But since there's a mystery about what this dark energy actually is, we want to go and test different models. Now, as I said, David's going to talk a little bit more about some different models soon. But I wanted to note that at the moment there's three different classes when it comes to the observational constraints on these models. You either get things like this is the one I just showed. You get some models which are simply bad fits to the data. They might be able to fit one observation, but they can't fit observations of all different types of things. And so we can relatively confidently exclude those. The next type of model are models whose best fit is degenerate with lambda CDM. So lambda CDM is our standard model with dark energy that I showed on the previous plot. And the thing with these models is that no matter how good our supernova data gets, we'll never be able to distinguish between these models and a vacuum energy, dark energy, with that data, as long as it stays the same as a lambda CDM. So we need different types of tests to be able to distinguish these. And that's what I'm going to talk about in a sec. The other models are the ones that are just poorly constrained. And again, different types of tests are what we need. If I was to plot all of those different models up here, here's a whole bunch of different models that give different explanations for what the dark energy might be. And you can see that they all do equally well at describing the data that we have at the moment. But that's just the supernova data. Now when I moved to UQ, which was a couple of years ago, I joined a project that had already been started called WIGGLES. And WIGGLES is looking for wiggles in the power spectrum. It's looking for fluctuations in the universe, and to use them as standard rulers to measure cosmological parameters. So to explain a little bit about what these are, here you have a picture of a summary of the evolution of our universe in one slide, where here you have observational data from the cosmic microwave background. Now that bit, that's the radiation that's left over after the Big Bang. Two Nobel Prizes have gone for the discovery of this. The first one was the discovery by Penzias and Wilson that this is almost a perfect black body. It's the most perfect black body ever measured, temperature of 2.725 degrees Kelvin. And the second Nobel Prize went to Smoot and Mather for the discovery of the fluctuations, tiny 10 to the minus 5 variations in the temperature that have a very distinctive pattern. And that pattern is really important because we can use that to understand a lot about physics. And what happens is the hot and cold spots that we see in the CMB are actually over and under densities that collapsed eventually and over time became the galaxies and structures that we see today. So the project, where these fluctuations come from is really interesting because we think that the fluctuations are actually indications of quantum physics. If you go to small enough scales, you end up with space-time foam. I'm assuming people are somewhat familiar with some of these concepts. When you have these quantum fluctuations on small scales, whatever caused the Big Bang, whatever caused the universe to start to accelerate, possibly expanded things so quickly, we have a theory called inflation that's related to this, where the universe was inflated so quickly and accelerated so strongly early on that quantum fluctuations became real, much like you get around the event horizon of a black hole where you have a steep gravitational gradient. You have quantum fluctuations turning into real ones, virtual particles being created. And so the fluctuations that we see in the universe are similar in a way to that, and leftovers from this enormous period of acceleration in the early universe. So I think it's absolutely stunning that this pattern that we see on large scales in every direction on the sky is related to quantum physics, it's related to the fluctuations in the vacuum that existed before inflation. And by measuring the details of this, we can measure details on the large scale of things that happen on very small scales. So I just wanted to describe very quickly a little bit that happened before this CMB was emitted. So the quantum fluctuations happened, and then imagine that you have a density fluctuation in the early universe. This is when the universe was really hot and dense, so everything is so compressed that you have you have the everything's basically coupled to everything else. What happened was that we say there's not supposed to be sound waves in space, but there were. There were sound waves in space. And if you had an initial density fluctuation, what happened is that the baryons and photons were coupled and that propagated as a sound wave. So here's an example of a dark matter fluctuation. The dark matter doesn't have any pressure, so it doesn't move out. But if you have baryons and other particles and photons, etc., they would expand out until the universe became rarefied enough that pressure waves could no longer propagate. And at that point, these density fluctuations get frozen in, and they make it like a standard scale, which relates to the pattern that we see in the cosmic microwave background. It doesn't actually happen with any one single peak like that. Of course, there was fluctuations on all scales. So what more likely happens is something more along these lines. But statistically, we can look for that that standard scale in the cosmic microwave background and in the galaxy distribution. So if I was to explain this slightly more detail, this is a description of how the, if we start out with an initial density fluctuation in the universe, it propagates out, the gas and photons propagate out as a sound wave. The dark matter stays behind because it's not pressure supported. The neutrinos will stream out of the overdensity because they're not coupled, they don't interact enough. This will continue for a while, until the point when the universe becomes rarefied enough that the photons and the gas decouple, the mean free path becomes too long, and effectively the photons then just travel all the way to our telescopes without interruption. So at that point, the gas gets frozen in. It can't propagate anymore because there's no pressure. So there's this distinctive peak that we end up with. And what happens is the dark matter pulls the baryons back into its gravitational well, and the baryons in turn pull the dark matter into their gravitational potential well. So what you end up with is a scale here. It's a characteristic scale, which is the separation of galaxies in the universe. Because these fluctuations we see in the cosmic microwave background, and they also appear in the galaxy distribution. So that's what I moved to Australia to join a team that was actually measuring that in the galaxy distribution. Here's a bunch of names. Here's the telescope that we're using. Here's Michael Drinkwater's handwriting on the dome. That was using a flashlight on the dome when on one day where the telescope wasn't exactly behaving itself and we needed to get repairs. Here's a snapshot of our data. We're basically trying to get spectra and distances to 250,000 galaxies and measure the distribution of galaxies in the universe so we can detect these sound waves. This is an example of the distribution of what we've measured. The yellow data is the data from our survey, and that's overset with data from some other surveys. So these are just positions of galaxies, and we use these positions to quantify the structure in the universe. So while there's a lot of empty space there that we haven't yet observed, it takes a fair bit of effort. But these points represent about 200,000 galaxies. So how do we quantify that? Well, we use power spectrum and correlation functions. I'm going to go quickly because I need to leave time for David and Sina here. But power spectra basically measure how much structure you get at different scales. So if you have basically two blobs in the universe, power spectrum, this is small scales, out at large wave numbers and large scales at small wave numbers. So if you have large scale structure, you'd get a peak at low wave numbers. If you only had small scale structure, you'd get a peak at high wave numbers. This is the actual power spectrum of the cosmic microwave background, and you see that there's structure on a variety of scales. Definitely not random. Definitely has clear peaks. We can do the same thing for the matter in the universe, for the galaxies. So here's a matter power spectrum. This is what happens to the matter power spectrum as you change the amount of total matter in the universe. And this is what you get if you add baryons. So stuff like us. The more baryons you get, the more wiggles you get in the power spectrum, which is the signal of the sound waves. If you take the Fourier transform of the power spectrum, you look at a correlation function, and these little wiggles turn into a peak in the correlation function. And I've got some hot off the press, not yet published, we're just writing up the paper on this right now, data. This is the correlation function from wiggles that we've measured with our current sample of about 200,000 galaxies. And you might not think this is much, but this sends shivers down my spine. This little peak that you see in these few data points that are sticking up here, that's evidence for this remnants of this sound wave that was traveling in the early universe. And so we've detected that now at a sort of about 3 sigma significance, and we've still got a little bit more data to come in, so that's going to be great, and we're using that to constrain the parameters of the universe. Now, I think I'm taking far too long, so I should give on to David and Sine. The one thing that... there's a whole bunch of other stuff that we can use with astrophysics. One thing that I've not mentioned is, so far that I've sort of been talking about two-dimensional stuff. I haven't talked yet about the motions of the universe. And that's something that's really, really powerful, because not only do we measure the expansion with all these geometric probes, but we can actually measure things that fall into clusters. So if you have a cluster of galaxies, say, we're the observer here, and this is a cluster of galaxies, we don't see everything moving easily with the expansion of the universe. You see galaxies that are further away, they're infalling into that cluster, so they get a bit of a blue shift. And the galaxies nearby us get a bit of a red shift. So the galaxies nearby us actually look falsely far away because they've got an extra red shift. And the galaxies that are far away that have got the extra blue shift look falsely close together. So if you look at a spherical structure, it actually looks compressed when you look at it and derive the distances just using the redshifts. So you get a compressed structure here instead of a spherical structure. This is correlation functions here. And we've also measured that in the wiggles data, looking to a power spectrum, so the elongation direction is the opposite way. You see that these redshift-based distortions, thanks to matter infalling into clusters. And this is an extremely useful piece of information, because it breaks the degeneracy with models that predict the same expansion history. They do differently when it comes to this. So that's what David's going to tell us about, using this quantitative thing of growth of structure. And actually measuring the velocity is something else we can do. But I'll skip over that for the moment and pass on to David to tell you about growth of structure.
So thank you very much, Tamara, for sacrificing a portion of your time to let me speak. So I'm going to go fairly quickly through this, because I know that Sina has to speak as well. So this is about, I'm going to speak very briefly about using this kind of data to test theories of gravity. So general relativity, as established, is basically a kind of scale invariant theory. That is, we can rescale different quantities relating to distance, time, and energy, and we get back the same laws, the same behavior. But it appears to break down. If we look at the motions of particles that we see, such as galaxies, and we measure then their energy density, what we find is a deficit. That is, we find that the particles don't behave as we expect them to, given the amount of matter, or given the properties of the matter that we can measure. So this deficit, we normally write down in terms of some kind of dark fluid, whether it be dark matter on the scales of galaxies, or then, as Tamara mentioned, the mysterious dark energy, which doesn't even behave as matter, but rather causes the expansion between galaxies to accelerate. But could it be then that instead of this deficit, instead of some dark, as of yet undetected fluid, simply this part of the equation is wrong? That general relativity, as we understand it on the scales of the Earth and the solar system, when we move up to these very large scales, then breaks down. So this is the analogy here is with the development of general relativity a century ago. There were problems with the measurement of the precession of the perihelion of Mercury. May, so which they named Vulcan, which was causing Mercury to move in an unexpected fashion. But then Einstein posited in fact that Newton's laws were wrong for these sort of strong field of gravity. And then in fact, some of the relativity could make the correct predictions for how Mercury should move. But the trouble is that when you generate these new theories, which I'm going to speak about in a second, you need them to match the tests of GR that we've already made on scales of the solar system. In other words, we need some kind of crossover scale where we go from GR behavior to some new theory. So what kind of new theories exist? So one of these is known as F bar, that is, we replace the Richter scale term in the Einstein-Hilbert action with a more complex function of the Richter scale. So it's normally just R, but if you have some higher order term, such as R squared, etc., then you get more interesting behavior. And you might then be able to recover the acceleration of the universe by time. And this has a next scale associated with it. It's the Compton wave vector. Like, it's not really a Compton wave vector because we're not dealing with a particle here. But rather, it's a kind of curvature scale in which the important new behavior starts to take over. Another alternative theory to GR is DGP, as Tamara quickly mentioned, the Dvalin-Ganzet-Perrard model, where gravity leaking, where the universe as we see it is fixed on a four-dimensional membrane, which is moving in some five-dimensional space, and gravity is allowed to leak away in this five-dimensional space. So this again has a characteristic length scale, which is in fact set by the Hubble scale. Because the dynamics of the acceleration set by this scale, then the length scale of which gravity changes over from GR to something new has to be equivalent. Already, though, experimental evidence suggests that the DGP model can be ruled out on a high level of significance. Finally, then there's a massive gravity, as it's becoming known, cascading gravity. So there are different models of massive gravity. The idea that the graviton, the exchange force particle for gravity, has some mass quite old, but there have been problems with it in the past to do with the extra scale of degree of freedom you get when you go back to the short-term limit. This again has a length scale which is basically set by the Compton wave vector for gravity. That is, it will behave as kind of massive particles on small scales and massive. And then there are these other theories as well, scalar tensor gravity, Galilean cosmology, F of G, where G is the Galilean term, rather than F of R, emergent gravity, etc. So how can we test these things? How do we test any theory of gravity? We watch particles fall towards each other. In cosmology, these particles are fluctuations of density, that is, structure in the universe. And the structure starts at these small quantum fluctuations, early time, and then slowly accumulate under gravity. But this rate of growth is not just given by the expansion integral, it's defined by the theory of gravity, and if you have different behavior on different scales, then we'd expect to see different rates of growth, especially on the very large scales. The rate of growth, d log delta, or the delta is your density perturbation, over d log a, where a is the scale factor, that is the size of the universe. It's given by this, it's normally detected by this thing F, sorry, I've used F twice, which is related to the density of matter raised to some power gamma. So it's just that on a very large scale, just linear physics, linear. So we're not talking about back reaction or non-linear runaway gravitational growth, just a very simple parochial structure, just given by this power. And then these different theories of gravity, which I've mentioned, could make different predictions for this rate of growth. So here is a plot showing this quantity F, this growth of structure, times some normalization of the amount of crossing, which we call sigma A, as a function of redshift. So here we are at redshift 0, and this goes back in time. So here are the different models. I'll just briefly summarize. So the blue model is our lambda CDM, that is, dark energy is just the cosmological constant, and then some cold dark matter of about just under 30%. this red line below is the DGP model, which has been mentioned. This purple and cyan model lines are this F of R gravity with different values of the quantum wave length B. And then this green, sorry, that's the green, but sorry, I'm getting confused by my own plot. And then we have the cyan line, which is the mass of gravity, where the quantum wavelength of graviton is about 600 megaparsecs. So, as Cameron mentioned, we have this data from the Wiggle survey, which is measuring this function F through these registered space distortions. And we already have this data, and then it looks like this. So basically, of course, we can move for some of these models. The DGP line is kind of fixed. The scale with DGP is fixed by the Hubble rate, so we don't really have any freedom to move this red line. So once again, red line is kind of ruled out again. Whereas with the F of R gravity and the mass of gravity, because we have this freedom to change the scale at which these effects become important, we can have limits on where the crossover scale takes over. Very probably what we'll find is that this crossover scale will become very large in the case of mass gravity, or this B friend will become zero. So zero in F of R is equivalent to the normal general relativity thing. And what we'll find is that these parameters are very close to what we'd expect from GM. And now I'll pass over to Sina, who's going to talk about something different.
I'm very happy to be here to show you some new results on measuring the neutrino masses in cosmology. The neutrinos are the lightest particles that we know. Actually, they're massless in the standard model. But we have measured massless in neutrino oscillation experiments. So that's kind of a problem. If the neutrinos have a mass, they will have an effect of structure formation, on the structure formation. Because as Tamara showed the evolution of density fluctuations, the neutrinos don't couple to anything, so they spread out, and that way they also spread out the gravitational potential. And here we have a power spectrum, and if we have very light neutrinos, then they will affect huge range of scales, but because they don't have a lot of mass themselves, they won't affect the scales so much. Whereas if we go to heavier neutrinos, they will move slower, but they will affect the scales more, so they will press basically small scales. So what we have here is like this is small scales, this is large scales, and this is the amount of structure. So we'll simply observe less structure on small scales depending on the neutrino mass. And currently, the best constraint of the neutrino mass, the sum of neutrino masses, comes from cosmology and not from particle physics. By combining a galaxy survey called Sloan Digital Sky Survey with the cosmic microwave background, then you can obtain it as limit of 0.62 electron volt on the sum of the neutrino masses. And I'm pretty confident that we can improve that using the Wiggles data. I think we just set all this. So here we have the Wiggles power spectrum here. And what we do is we assume standard cosmology. So we basically assume none of all the stuff David is concerned about. Just assume that they've understood all of the evolution of the universe. Might be a false statement, but let's do that for now. And then we predict the amount of structure for a given neutrino mass. That's the blue curve here. Then we have all the effects that galaxies might not. We are measuring galaxies, and our predictions are just for the dark matter. So the galaxies might not sit exactly the same places as the dark matter, so that gives us a bias. We also have the effect of the redshift space distortions that Tamara just talked about that will make spheres compressed. We try to model that as good as we can. That turns the blue model into the green model. Then we have the fact that we don't observe all of the sky, but just we have part of the sky. That turns the green model into the red model. So that's basically what we're fitting to the data. And the reason why we believe we can do better than SDSS is if you look at the green model and the blue model out here at very small scales, linear theory. And that gives us a limited range of where we can do the fitting, limited scale where we actually believe our model is good enough. But as we move to higher redshifts, so higher and higher redshifts, so this is looking further away, so further back in time where the universe is younger, so these nonlinear effects haven't had time to kick in. You see the two models are much more similar in shape. So we might actually hope that we can fit a broader range of scales. And fitting all these power spectra, we use the Wiggles power spectrum, and then we need the cosmic microwave background from WMAP to constrain the rest of the parameters, because we have six cosmological parameters, being the amount of dark matter, the amount of baryons, the expansion rate, the spectral index, and the amount of curvature fluctuations at the time of the plating. And basically what I want to take away from this very complicated slide is that if we're looking at the WMAP constraints on the cosmological parameters alone, they constrain five of the cosmological parameters very well just by itself, so that's excluding the neutrino mass. But it doesn't contain a lot of information on the neutrino mass. So if you combine it with the Wiggles power spectrum and use the shape of the Wiggles power spectrum to constrain the neutrino mass, then we make a huge improvement from 1.2 electron volts, 0.7 electron volts on the power on the neutrino mass. That's basically this one, which is the relative probability as a function of the neutrino mass. This is the 95% confidence limit, and the grade of the W relative in the red curve here. And then when we add the Wiggles data, we go to this red curve, with this line being 95% confidence. And that is, we're getting quite close to the limit of SDSS, even though SDSS is a much larger surveyor than Wiggles. And currently we are not, this is just fitting to the very limited range of scales. So we hope that we can improve this by extending the range of scale using the high redshift data. And since we're not done observing yet, this is not done for all the data, so we can improve by including all of the data. So basically we can use cosmology to constrain particle physics.
Thanks, guys. So I'll just throw up some conclusions there then. I've got a couple of slides of things that if you feel like asking questions about, there's a whole bunch of other different interesting things that we can do with cosmology. They include measuring the topology of the universe. This is a picture of the topology of the universe over and under dense regions and what they look like, and you can quantify that. And use that to test non-Gaussianity and understand inflation. We also use standard clocks, which I haven't measured, and we use supernovae to measure time dilation in the universe. And this is another thing that we did that I like to... We got written up in Nature for this, and I like to put that as this. That's the shocking news that astronomers confirmed the expansion of the universe. But there's all sorts of other time delay measurements that you can make in the universe as well, which can help you understand Lorentz invariants and things like that. And then the other thing that I'm excited about at the moment, which I've just been involved in a successful discovery project to measure it a bit better, is testing whether the transitions that we see in atoms at great distances are the same as the transitions we see on Earth, and check whether the fine structure constant that governs the spacing of lines and spectra is actually the same in the distant universe compared to here. So using the timescales that we have with cosmology to test whether things like the constants of nature could vary. So these are the other kind of things that we're interested in. And all I'm hoping that the take-home message from this talk is hopefully that you get the impression that there's an absolute wealth of information that astrophysics has to offer. Tests of fundamental physics. I'll leave the rest up for you to have a read of there. Thanks very much.